An aversion is just really a very interesting thing to try to take a look at. Yogini Devi said, you know, if you don't hold, how can you let go of pain if you never really took hold of it? You know, you've got to hold it first before you can let it go. And so the same is true for greed, hatred, and delusion. It's an opportunity for investigation, you know. So you hear those words and you think, oh, what fun. And the truth is, it can be. It can be. I was here on Tuesday, and Tim Guile, one of the guiding teachers here, who I'm very grateful to because he invited me back, I think I thanked him. He did a very skillful examination of something remarkably mundane that happened at home, that his wife moved some clothespins. It's not really a very big deal, you know? And at the same time, he had this aversive response to it. And he stayed and worked with the aversion and was able to see that his aversion really had nothing to do with what was going on in the present moment. And that's exactly what this teaching this evening is about. How we can take our aversion and hopefully investigate it enough to be able to determine what's the reality of what is going on. Meanwhile, I don't know, if you're like me, there's aversion arising every day because of all that's going on in the world. Aversion, you know, in response to the greed that I perceive happening. And often it appears hateful behavior, and my response is sometimes hateful too. I'm just so upset by this, what appears to be a deliberate intention to cause suffering. In my perspective. And so how do you hold all that? Especially when it seems like every day it escalates. It's something worse. Just when you thought they've hit rock bottom, something else happens, you know? And for whatever it's worth, everybody's entitled to their opinion about what's going on. I'm just very frightened these days that more of us will suffer because of actions that are being taken. The notion that here, come March, 800,000 people might be deported because of the rescission of DACA. And even as we speak, they're building prototypes of what that wall is supposed to look like, or what it might be like. So these are very, very remarkable times, especially, you know, if you identify as an immigrant as I do. Simultaneously, we can look at all those people and we can say, oh, they're wrong, they shouldn't be doing this, I'm really upset about this, I wish I could do something about this. And I just turn to Lao Tzu, who says, if you want to awaken all of humanity, then awaken all of yourself. If you want to eliminate suffering in the world, then eliminate all that is negative in yourself. Truly, the greatest gift you have to give is that of your own self-transformation. So that's why we come here. And just as Tim noticed what was happening in that moment in his daily householder life, we sit quietly in order to be able to investigate and perceive all the nuances of a moment, feelings arising, thoughts arising, sensations, so that we can slow down enough to really take a good look at what's going on. What is really going on here? So I'd like to begin with just a 10-minute sit that will just sort of bring us into the room. I know people who come here regularly are accustomed to sitting up front, and I would like to end with a nice half-hour sit so that we are informed, our meditation is informed by the teaching, as compared to the other way around. But we'll do 10 minutes here just to bring us into the room and quiet ourselves down. So I encourage you to find a comfortable position. And we'll begin with what I refer to as a community breath. Should you have the inclination, breathing in for 4 counts, holding for 4 counts, and releasing for 4 counts, the invitation is to add a little sound both to the inhale and exhale so that we might have a sense of one another. Many of us have daily practice alone, at home. Today, we're in spiritual community, so maybe we can sense that with a little bit of sound in our breathing. So, breathing in. And hold. Release. And that gentle breath is the sound of our practice together. Breathing in. And release. One last time, breathing in. And allowing your breath to find its own rhythm without effort. Setting the intention to put aside all that has occurred today, all that got you riled up, all that might have caused aversion to arise, even that which caused great joy to arise, and coming to a more neutral place in our sit. Not leaning in any direction, and allowing equanimity to arise. So I've been in Seattle since April, and I'm living in an apartment in Leschi, just 1 block away from the Leschi Elementary School. So sometimes I go for walks, you know, and I go right by the playground. And 200 kids, one ball, and everybody's happy, you know? Everybody's just having a great time. It really doesn't take very much. So when I hear that sound from my apartment, because I work from home, you know, I have this feeling of appreciative joy. You know, mudita rises, like, oh, love, they sound like they're having a great time, you know? You watch kids, and when they're happy, it's hard not to smile, or for me it is, anyway. Simultaneously, over the summer, I noticed that right on the other side of the property where I'm at, there's high hedges, so I can't see a darn thing, but it seems that right on the other side of the fence, there was I perceived to be a little girl. And during the day, she was playing in the yard and screaming her head off, you know? Just screaming this shrill, loud shriek incessantly. You know, and so I'm doing my metta practice, you know, and it's like, whatever, you know, but it just persisted, and eventually, I had this really strong aversive response. So then the story started to happen. What's wrong with those parents? How could they let their child scream and upset all the quiet? You know, what's going on? And I got really, really upset. And it happened day after day after day, and that same very strong, overwhelming aversion arose in me, and I felt like I had to blame someone for it. It was that little girl's fault. It was her parents' fault. They all should know better, right? One day I got so riled up, it's like, I'm going to go talk to them, right? I get in the car and I drive around the corner and I'm right in front of the house and I got my hands on the steering wheel. It's like, okay, John, you can choose skillful action, which will lead to the end of suffering, or you can choose unskillful action, which will increase suffering. What are you choosing? And I drove back home that day. You know? And then, you know, so it happened the next day. Screaming. Just like, at some point I felt like she had to have been in distress, you know, that maybe someone was hurting her. You know, all kinds of ideas arose in my head. And then one hit that was like, this is just not normal. And then it hit me. This child might very well be on the spectrum. That this might be a special child of some sort. And as soon as that happened, compassion flooded me. You know, it's like, oh, I get it now. And those parents who I thought weren't worth a dime, all of a sudden it was like, oh my God, what they have to do, what they have to live with. My, you know, bless them, you know. So as soon as the story was not about me, compassion arose. But as long as it was about me, I was greedy. Because everybody's supposed to be quiet. Now that I've been practicing for 17 years, I need quiet, right? Especially during the day. And then, of course, if they're not quiet, I have the right to be angry. And that angry breeds this hatred, you know? And of course, assuming that things are supposed to go my way 24/7 is total delusion. We all know that. Things don't go our way all the time. Tenesaro Biko says, the Buddha only points the way. It's up to us to follow the path. This means that we have to be responsible. We have to be clear about our intentions, mature about admitting when we have some unskillful intentions in mind, and honest about the results that come when we act on unskillful intentions. Only by observing that again and again can we finally get tired of those intentions. When we really see there's a direct connection between unskillful intentions and needless suffering, we can become genuinely motivated to find the escape from that suffering. This is the only way we can do it. And that little girl made it so clear to me that it was like, I'm dedicating this Dharma talk to her. She inspired it, right? And it was easy, when I look back on it, to continue to suffer and to stress and to grit my teeth about it and to hold myself in tension. And as soon as I let that go and compassion arose, that was so much easier, so much more pleasant. And yet I had this inclination to hold on to the negative. You know, in the book, The Buddha's Brain, Rick Hansen, who I see over at Spirit Rock often, He says the brain is Velcro for negativity and Teflon for positivity, right? So if it's negative, we're on it, you know? And you see this, certainly you see it on Facebook. It's sort of like, let me put this in your face. It hurts, I can't hold it, here, you hold it. You know, let me shove this in your face today, you know? And it's just our inclination. I heard say that, you know, that at the core of our brains, as we have evolved over time, there's this reptilian brain, you know? And I tend to believe it because I saw that video of a fetus forming in its mother's womb, you know? Well, you know, in the beginning, we're looking a lot like seahorses, you know? It looks very, very much like a reptile. And then the mammalian brain wrapped around that, the animal brain, and then the human brain has wrapped around that, and now our heads are this size. That reptilian brain is connected directly to the amygdala on either side that holds threat. So all of a sudden that noise was a threat to my well-being, to my peace of mind. And I had a fight or flight response. Then when I saw it, it was like, none of that suffering was necessary. I could have had a compassionate response the first day I heard it. Not unlike the response I had with the kids in the yard. And they were much louder than this little girl. So owning it, you know, owning it. I used to study with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, the death and dying scientist. I really adored her. I still do. Her teachings are still invaluable to me. And I remember I was on an intensive retreat with her for 2 weeks, and she said, if it lasts more than 14 minutes, it's about something else. I don't know where she got that number from, but I hold it as a tenet, a truth that I am with all the time. And things last a lot longer than 14 minutes all daily. It's about something else. So what could it have been about, you know, outside of the fact that I like quiet anymore? After, you know, being in these rooms for the many years that I've been. What could it have been about? And I thought about how, you know, just go back to early childhood, not unlike what Tim Guile did the other day with the clothespins. He related it to a childhood experience. So, you know, when I was a kid, you know, my oldest sister was killed in a car accident. I was about a year old. So that sort of did, you know, traumatized my family. Disconnect with mom, because she was grieving so deeply. And I was about 5 when my father contracted Alzheimer's. Early onset, at that time we didn't even know what it was. They didn't diagnose it. So I grew up in a household where there really wasn't any room for children, particularly, you know? And my needs were never as important as other people's needs. I was always tending to my mother's emotional well-being and my father's actual physical care. So it's, you know, it's resentment there. When's my turn? When do my needs become important? You know? So that's a core issue for me. And that little girl triggered it. So like, I need quiet. And it was taken away. And I was powerless to do anything about it. And it reminded me of a time when I was powerless to do anything about it. And this really is our purification process, to take those moments and to not feel self-righteous about them, to not escalate conflict or aversion or your own personal suffering, but to take the invitation, to accept the invitation to investigate, to take a look at what's really going on. Desmond Tutu says, we do not need to succumb to the temptation to meet violation with retaliation. The only way to heal this hurt is to give voice to what ails us. It is the only way that we can keep our pain and loss from taking root inside us. It is the only this way we have a chance for freedom. Choosing wholesome versus unwholesome. Skillful versus unskillful. The end of suffering rather than more suffering. This is our daily choice, and that's why we sit for extended periods of time in quiet, so that we can notice that, because these things arise on a moment-by-moment basis all the time. And they invite wise view, clear seeing. I dare say, I like to think that it's because of my meditation practice that one day I went, oh, this is not normal. She may be on the spectrum, and I transformed. Because otherwise I could have been in mediation or, you know, calling and causing upset, greater upset. I have a house in Oakland. I really like it, and there's, you know, a lot of houses not unlike it. And they're different houses, but basically every house has got two parking spaces in front of it. And houses have one or two garages, you know, as well. And so there's, you know, plenty of parking. I have two roommates, housemates, and one of them parks in front of the house. I get to park in the garage, and the other one parks on the other side. And I have these neighbors that I have known and loved for a long time. Now, about 9 years. And they had a friend who, for some reason, chose to park in front of my house, even though they had both their cars in their garage and there were two spaces in front of the house he was actually visiting. And not only did he park in front of my house, he parked right in the middle, so nobody else could park there, you know. You know, of course, I was upset because I wanted my housemate to be able to walk into the house safely, you know. And I asked her, I said, what do you think about it? What's going on for you? And she said, oh, let it go. It doesn't matter. I'll just park across the street. So obviously it wasn't about her. It was totally about me. And so I just left him a little note. I said, you get to park wherever you want. I'd appreciate it if you didn't take both spaces when you park in front of the house. Thanks for your consideration. I thought I was diplomatic, you know, and kind. I wasn't mean or angry or any of those things. I didn't want to start anything. Well, then it seemed like with a vengeance he came back and always parked in the right in the middle and never made the exception. He didn't hear me again. My needs were disregarded. So I can't tell you what I went through around that. You know, it's like, I'm gonna key the car, or set it on fire, you know. Just these crazy hateful things. You know, here I am sitting here being a Dharma teacher. And this stuff was arising. So first of all, let me say that this stuff does arise. And it's not like, you know, certainly the quote says you must take responsibility for it. But it's not like I chose to have these thoughts. Thoughts just happen. And the causes and conditions of our lives is what caused them to arise. It's not necessarily that because I'm thinking it, I think I chose to think it. But that's not the case at all. It's just a thought arising. It's not volitional necessarily by any means. So for whatever it's worth, these hateful thoughts were rising, and I was thinking, why is he doing that, etc., etc. And again, the compassion came over, and it's like, ah, he's suffering. He wants my attention. This is the only way he knows how to get it. Otherwise, I wouldn't pay attention to him, maybe. And then, you know, my heart went out to him. It's like, oh. When I realized that his behavior was because he was suffering, then it no longer caused me suffering. Then compassion superseded it. And that happens a lot today in politics, right? It's hard to have a compassionate response to what we may perceive as some of the atrocious, hateful, divisive things that are being done and said. A friend of mine took me out for my birthday recently, and we went to hear Joe Mama Jones over at On the Boards, you know? A wonderful concert, wonderful concert. And he said, you know, in this time, because so much is going on, really, the inclination for us is to have a contraction, to close our hearts, to guard them, because we're frightened and afraid that if we're open, we might get hurt. Because it certainly feels threatening out there. And he said, can we turn that around? What if the most appropriate response to all that is happening in the world today is to actually open our hearts, to be receptive, to be more empathetic? And of course, that was another invitation to compassion. So there are ways that we can check on greed when it arises in us, you know? I can't do it for somebody else unless they ask for my help. You know, it's the thing the Buddha says, we're all subject to greed, hatred, and delusion. It's not for me or for you to determine which of those is true for me, right, at any given moment. Oh, you're all greed today, or you're all hatred today, you know? It's for us to decide what's arising. So when the, you know, certainly when you want things to go your way 24/7, you know, certainly this is what entitlement and privilege is all about, right? Of course it's supposed to go my way. What is it that is actually happening in that moment? And you might ask yourself a few questions. What else do I need in this moment? Do I want something else to happen? Or is something happening and you don't want it to happen, right? So the else would be that behavior, that screaming, that parking should stop. Even though that's not the reality of this present moment. And as greed is arising, always good to Just ask yourself, where is contentment in this moment? It's always there. It's just our capacity to connect to it. And then, of course, the antidote to greed is generosity. The same way Jerry made the request, and I thank you in advance for any generosity you might send my way, or on the way to Sims and the infrastructure of this lovely space we get to be here tonight with no charge at the door. And generosity asks, what can I offer in this moment? What do I have to offer? It's not only just something that I might want to give, but what can I surrender? What do I need to let go of in this moment? And generosity always asks, do things need to go my way 24/7 in order for me to be happy? And you know people who are like that, who will find the smallest thing and turn it into a lifetime of misery. Generosity asks, do things need to always go the way you want? And we all know the answer to that. Of course, the antidote to hatred is love. The scriptures say that greed takes us into the realm of hungry ghosts. Hungry ghosts in Buddhist scriptures. You know, Tim mentioned them on Tuesday. Small mouth, big belly, they can never get filled, they can never get sated. Hatred takes us into the hell realm. Right? There's no escaping. And, you know, we'd like to think that injustice requires an apology. If you've been harmed, you want to know that it won't happen again. Is that always true? Is that always going to happen? MLK says, let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. Confucius says, before you embark on a journey of revenge, dig two graves. So, to check on hatred, we might ask ourselves, what is it that I want to stop happening? And then, am I really wishing someone harm in this moment? Because the ill will arises, and the fantasies about revenge and what we're going to do to them, and it arises. It's a part of our humanity, our reptilian brain. To check on hatred, one we might ask, is my happiness dependent on something being different than it really is? Because this is what's happening in this moment, when it's clear to us. How do we practice equanimity? How do we come to acceptance? And then we might ask, what would happen if I did not direct my anger outwardly? This big Pema teaching, you know? Tim talked about it on Tuesday, actually. You know, it's sort of like, that is all about what it means to be moving in your mind and to give credence to your thoughts and to actually then act out of your thoughts, right? Where the recommendation is always to return to the body, do a body scan, check in with the breath, come to a less cognitive, a more physical reality of what's occurring in this present moment. You know, make it simple. Experience yourself in your skin. Experience your breath as the life-giving force that it is. And don't let the mind spin. Skillful, unskillful. No suffering, less suffering, more suffering. Always return to the body. A part of what it means to be the youngest in my family, and I have a brother that's 19 years my senior, is to see my siblings age much sooner than, you know, I'm 66, but, you know, my brother's 85. And I'm in constant communication with all of them, you know. But it really is a lesson on what does it mean to grow older and to not grow bitter? Because that is so much a part, you know, after living the life and working and raising a family, whatever the heck it is that we've done, we want things to be easy, and they don't get easier. The body starts to fail us. What we could do last year, we can no longer do this year. It's a huge frustration. Just when we're looking for greater peace, and that's the conundrum. Not that we can't age healthfully, we can. And many of us do, and God bless. And, you know, I was all upset at work recently, you know, about God knows what, that things weren't going the way I had hoped, you know. It was really upsetting, and people are, you know, I house the homeless for a living, and people are fighting that. Can you imagine? They're fighting that they don't want me to house the homeless. That's really what's going on. It's like, so I'm all upset, you know, and I have this contract manager over at the Housing Finance Commission, and she just sends me this email. She says, I hope you don't think I have been unresponsive as of late, you know? I was like, no, I don't. I haven't had that thought at all. She said, because I've just gone through my first round of chemo. Suddenly that band of neighbors really was put in perspective, you know? Because that is life. There is suffering, the first noble truth. And where we want to focus is on number three, the end of suffering. And that's why we come here. That's why we talk about these difficult moments in our lives, these difficult human inclinations that cause suffering, that we might be able to understand them better and make better choices, choices that lead us to less suffering. In this way, we all have the invitation to take on the vows of the Bodhisattva, you know? That if the world is a sea of suffering, the sea of samsara, we vow to not add another drop. And it's so much easier when we think about, of course, I'm not going to cause anyone else suffering. I would do my darndest not to do that. But we don't do it for ourselves. So like, what are the choices that I have to make sure that I suffer less? About whatever it is that's going on. How do we hold love at the center of our lives? We can't do it 24/7, but, you know, can we do it more? What do we have to lose? A little suffering or a lot? And then delusion. So for me, the check, the antidote to delusion is clear seeing, clear understanding, a real perspective. And to check our delusion, we might ask, what is really going on in this moment? Why am I so upset? And we may feel justified. There's a lot to feel justified about. And this is not asking for passivity. If the end of suffering looks like organizing and protesting and some kind of movement to try to end the suffering for yourself or other people because you are part of a group or want to help another group. That is number three. That's the end of suffering, right? But in these day-by-day moments, I like to ask myself, is this really about what's going on now? Or is it about something that's happened to me in the past? Most often, it's the latter. Most often, I can take it back to that little boy in that house with a dead sister and an Alzheimer's father. Trying to get his needs met. And the delusion says, I can get them met all the time. And we all know that's not true. Who amongst us hasn't experienced deep disappointment, grief, loss, betrayal? No one is exempt. So, we're about to take just a 5-minute break, and then we'll come back and we'll wrap up our evening with meditation. But before we go on break, I would like to share this quote for you, written in 1680 by François Fénelon. He says, "As light increases, we see ourselves to be worse than we thought. We are amazed at our former blindness as we see issuing from the depths of our hearts a whole swarm of shameful thoughts and feelings. We never could have believed that we had harbored such things, and we stand aghast as we watch them gradually appear. But we must neither be amazed nor disheartened. We are not worse than we were. On the contrary, we are better. But while our faults diminish, the light by which we see them waxes brighter, and we are filled with horror. Bear in mind, for your comfort, that we only perceive our malady when the cure begins." So, back in 5.